Drama on One.
Sundays at 8 p.m.
rte.ie/drama on one.
Drama on One.
Drama on One is offered as a podcast at rte.ie/drama on one and of course here on RTE Radio 1 on Sunday nights. Tonight's Drama on One is Sinead by Eamon Breen. Having experienced a dramatic and life-changing event, Sinead is forced to retilt and re-evaluate. To this end, she's both encumbered and assisted by her ex-boyfriend Jimmy, her soon-to-be ex-best friend Millicent Murphy, and her therapist, Tell Your Truth, Ruth. With adult themes and content that some may find offensive, Hilary Rose stars as the eponymous young offender. This is Sinead by Eamon Breen.
I used to think I'd be lost without him. I didn't know what I'd do, we were so wrapped up together. I thought it would undo me. I mean, he didn't even think about things like that. It would never even have entered his head. Can you imagine that? Of course I could have asked him, popped the question, wait a long time for the answer, but that would be self-defeating if I had to coax the answer out of him. You'd think I'm shallow, but I'm not. I know I don't appear to be deep, thoughtful or sensitive, but still waters. It's not about him at all. It's about me. I thought I'd get that in early. Introductions first. Sinead, pronounced Sin-Aid. Eldest child of Patrick and Imelda, sister of Nora, Fintan and Oisín. Could have been a contender, but couldn't be arsed. Well, maybe not an actual contender, but maybe a possibility. I'm a bit wired. I've had 4 coffees today. I'll try to keep it together, but who knows? I don't really want to tell you this, but I need to. Really, I need to. So there I am, standing at the busy bus stop, enjoying the early morning London sunshine that bounces off King's Cross Station. I close my eyes briefly and relish the warmish tickle on my face and eyelids. I open my eyes and smile. Sounds a bit wanky, doesn't it? Sounds like I'm trying to write a story. It's not a story, it's a tale, really. A yarn. The bus arrives at 8:50 a.m. exactly on the dot, and we band of commuters gather to board. In other words, the usual collection of losers and freaks. A man, a businessman, swoops in to push on before me as the door opens, and this really irritates me. He's not going to get to work any sooner, and he certainly is not going to get a seat ahead of me. I quickly position myself in front of him and pause for a second to remind him that this is a queue. I can sense his impatience as I leisurely remove my bus pass from my bag and swipe it for Mr. Bus Driver. He winks, and I smile. As I replace my pass before moving on, Mr. Businessman shifts almost imperceptibly closer to my ear and says,
"Bitch."
My smile freezes to my face and I walk stiffly towards a free seat. Bitch, bitch, bitch. The word echoes in my ear like a symphony of male power. It's the old tune. Has anyone heard and seen what's just happened? I scan the bus and notice he's taken a seat near the front and is now reading his newspaper. I look at the window and I see myself reflected. My true self. Not the smiling, happy, sunshine on my face woman of 5 minutes ago, but a sad 30-ish one that could have easily cried out in anger, hurt and foolishness. Why did I have to block his way? What was I trying to prove? My ex-boyfriend Jimmy would always tease me and tell me off for trying to be right and fair about everything.
Relax. You're too young to worry.
I'm not that young, I'd snap back. Jimmy would laugh, thinking we were sparring. Now he misses a main conversation. Jimmy. Bit of background here before I race on. Jimmy and Sinead together for 8 years. 8 long years. Then he meets Tessa and fecks off with her. Jimmy was a kind, decent bloke in many ways, and not all. And he certainly didn't deserve me. People will tell you to judge everybody by their actions or their kindnesses or their morals. That, of course, is bollocks. You can tell a man by the type of jokes he tells. Jimmy insisted on telling jokes when we met friends, and this was a problem because one, he's not funny. Two, he didn't understand humour. And three, worst crime of all, he couldn't tell a story. It was a fatal combination. But that's men, isn't it? Example. We'd be out somewhere in a friend's house or a restaurant, and Jimmy would also misjudge the atmosphere. And when there was a lull, he'd launch into a joke like this. Cinderella wants to go to the ball.
The fairy godmother appears. Cinderella gets the whole thing, the dress, the shoes, the livery man and coach, the warning about midnight. Everyone is happy, including the mice. And then the fairy godmother smiles and asks, is there anything else you need? Well, fairy godmother, it's my time of the month. But don't worry, my darling. And she waves the magic wand, and there is a tampon fit for a princess. Off she goes to the ball, dancing with the prince, ignores the sisters. The bells of midnight begin to peal and she legs it for the exit. She's only just out the door and suddenly there is a blood-curdling scream. The tampon has changed back into a pumpkin.
Ugh, this is what I had to contend with. Of course my friends would politely laugh, but you could tell it was that condescending laughter. And the more riotous stuff would come later after we left. Anyway, a young man with a backpack who was behind me in the queue walks past and looks at me. I feel embarrassed. I look back at him with my helpless expression. He shrugs and winks at me, as if to say he knows how it feels. His nervous face breaks into a smile. It's a polite smile, a kind smile. And one that I'll remember for the rest of my life. The bus snakes its way up the Euston Road, avoiding pedestrians, cyclists and parked delivery vans. Slowly it turns towards Holborn instead of Gower Street, and I realise there's some kind of diversion again today. I jump up and get off just outside the church in the corner. I get a cigarette and I light up. My second of the day, and it tastes good. Then it happens. The explosion. It takes me ages to understand. The sound is deafening. People are running all around me. The scream leaves my throat as soon as I drop to the ground. There is smoke and silence. Then a car alarm goes off in the distance and I see people running towards the Euston Road.
Are you all right?
A man asks. I look at his bald head and brown framed glasses and think that he looks like my Uncle Padraig. And I wonder, what's he doing in London? And then I ask, has Aunt Alice passed her driving test yet?
Are you all right, love?
He asked politely, as if he was offering tea or coffee at a party. I'm going to be late for work, I eventually answer.
Don't worry about work.
It's all I have. I begin to cry. Why me? Why me? Why me? I need to get to work.
I'm going to put my arm around you, all right? All right? Come on. Let's just sit down.
I stand up slowly and walk towards the office. I get there about 10:30 and immediately tell everyone what has happened. David, my boss, tries to console me. He puts his arm around me and I think I might throw up all over his blue paisley tie.
It's going to be all right, Siobhan.
In my great tragedy, he still can't get my feckin' name right. I'm numb all over and tearful. I sit in the canteen and drink sugary tea and watch the events of the day unfold in a dreamlike way on the big TV. The news is on a loop and the repetition is very comforting. Everyone comes to talk to me, from the nurse to the security manager. I give my version of what I've witnessed. I embellish a little and I rush to get off. I'm annoyed about this as I'll be late for work. Suddenly there's an explosion. I turn around and realise it's the bus that I've just got off.
I can't believe I get the bus all the time.
Everyone around me is running. I stand fixed, like a statue. By lunchtime, I've convinced myself that I've dreamt about it the night before. Adrian from accounts offers to take me home, but I decline. Not used to that type of attention. I don't want to be on my own, so I continue to linger. When the phone networks finally come up, I start to get messages from friends and family. First, my sister Nora, a text message in capitals.
Be worried. Tell me all is okay, Nora.
Typical Nora, all about her, nothing about me.
Be worried.
Oh, don't make me laugh, I want to scream. I respond, also in capitals. only for the grace of God, I was on the bus. He looks after his favourites. I leave it vague, as I could be referring to a higher power, Nelson Mandela, or the bus driver. She hates it when I've anything more than her. She calls me immediately. I give her all the details and more.
Why you?
She asks. Exactly, I answer. That's all I can think of.
Can I get anything for you?
I tell her I've lost my purse.
Well, let me send you some money. Will 50 be enough?
I say nothing. I get her up to 200 and then tell her I need to go and pray. She loves this, as her husband Victor is a born-again Christian, which anyone can tell you is just a fancy name for a Protestant. Next, my mother. Now, my mother likes to call or speak on the phone when she's busy, like cooking dinner or getting ready to go out, so she can cut the call short when it suits her. But today, she must allow me to indulge. I give her the long version, including my dreams for the last 2 weeks, that all now point to a great tragedy with more to come.
Yes, I was on the bus. I was on the number 30. It's the bus that I get all the time. It's the one I get into work, the new job that I...
She's unusually responsive, as normally she doesn't hear anything I say, trapped for eternity in her own bubble of selfishness. My father can't come to the phone, as he's cutting the grass in the back garden. I close the call down quickly. Jimmy calls about 3 to check to see if I'm safe. Please come over. I could be dead if I didn't get off the number 30. I know he couldn't refuse. I feel lucky, and I feel cursed at the same time. Story of my life. Then, from New York, Millicent Murphy. Millicent Murphy is my best friend from school. Warm, happy, generous, witty, beautiful, and a lovely person. Always lands on her feet, whereas I, well, guess where I land. Millicent Murphy was nicknamed the Tallahassee Lassie by my grandfather, as when we had a family get-together, she always sang Ode to Billy Joe. The first time she did this, when she got to the part about jumping off the bridge, my grandmother wept. This was extraordinary, because in my family, nobody ever cried. Ever. In public or in private. Except for the time my grandmother, again, cried when Soames died in the Forsyte saga, which caused my grandfather to ask,
"Why are you crying? He's a bastard."
To which my grandmother shot back with,
"A lot you'd know about bastards."
"I was on the bus," I say.
"As I would expect,"
she quips.
"Remind me never to go on holidays with you. You're a bad luck magnet."
"I know," I say, fighting back the tears.
"Please tell me you didn't shift the bomber. You've the worst taste in men."
I laugh because she knows me so well and can sense my panic.
"I'm here for you."
And she hangs up. I talk to HR and they call the police. Martin, the advisor, says, "We're all in this together." They tell me I can have 3 days off compassionate leave. The rest of the day just evaporates before me. Eventually, I leave. The crowd of commuters walking up Holloway Road feels like clocking off time at the world's biggest factory. I get to my flat at 7, soak in the bath, and relive the events. I watch the TV till Jimmy arrives. Never in my life had I been so glad to see him. He looks younger, his brown hair short and his blue eyes clearer. He's earnest in his questions and on his best behaviour with no snide comments. I relay the story of my journey to work already forming into a strange fiction rather than pure facts.
"You were really lucky."
"I know. I can't believe it, Jimmy."
"Do you need to talk to the police?"
"Yeah, I do. I want to. I need to, apparently. They're sending someone tomorrow."
"Here?"
"No, at work, I think. I don't know. I'm a real mess. I can't remember anything."
"No, you'll be fine. Take it easy. I'll help, I promise."
I can tell he's jealous. "What about Tessa?" I ask casually.
She's cool. She knows I'm here."
"Thanks, Jimmy." I start to cry and marvel at my capacity, as I can't remember the last time I've been this emotional. He holds me in his strong arms. Just like it was when we first got together and he was my knight who was going to save me.
"Let's get you to bed. You must be exhausted."
We move towards the bedroom. Our old bedroom, which I'd recently decorated when I finally accepted he was not coming back. We sit on the bed in silence. He kisses me and we discard our clothes like robots. "Jimmy, do anything you want to me." Eventually, he finishes and lets out a long, painful sigh. We lie without speaking. The bedside clock is the only sound that accompanies our breathing, just like it was when we'd wait in bed on sunny mornings before the alarm went off for work. In the living room, the TV drones on with the same repetitive commentary. Jimmy pulls on his clothes and cautiously leaves the room. A moment later, I hear the front door close. The clock says 8:50 p.m. exactly. Only 12 hours have passed. And then, when I least wanted it, Skittle McGee calls. I'm afraid I've not been entirely honest. I mean, truthful. I mean, I've given an impression that is not, shall we say, straight. I get home from work and I get a call on the house phone from Mr. Skittles McGee. My first husband. I know. Me married. Imagine that. Well, technically, and if I'm honest, I'm very happy and content. But the problem is, well, was that God, in his infinite wisdom, decides not to bestow on me beauty, class, elegance, intelligence, or wit. Those he gives to Millicent Murphy, who takes the gifts and then does something with them. Me, probably the last in the queue that year, I get a capacity for alcohol, the ability to be argumentative, indifferent, and the best of all, to turn every man I love gay. Skittles McGee, champion bowler in his teens, hence the nickname, tells me on our second wedding anniversary that he's gay, always has been, and thanks me for helping him realise that sex with women is not for him, and leaves me for my cousin Terry Wainwright, local heartthrob and successful accountant. At my one and only church wedding after the first dance, my grandmother beckons me to the table. I bend down, as she's clearly not going to stand up, and she whispers in my ear.
I wish Millicent Murphy was here to witness this.
So, Skittles McGee calls, checks if I'm all right, offered to fly to London and bring me home, and I, like an idiot, decline the offer. He's so kind. It's hard to hate a good person, but not impossible. It takes time and practice. I tell him I need to go and start to hang up before he offers me money and his friendship. So then I say, fick off, Skittles, and take your queer money and guilt and shove it up the high hole of your arse. I hang up. Afterwards, I feel great. Better than I felt since the bomb. Wherever he is, I know Skittles belongs to me. I drink 4 cans of lager and fall asleep in front of the telly. At work the next day, HR asked to see me, and I panic as I think this is going to be about my performance or absence record, which is bad, or my attitude to senior management, or my timekeeping. They say I should be at home resting. I won't go. I refuse. I'll go mad if I stay there. I need to be at work. I need to be at work. I need to be around my friends at work. Of which I have none. They compromise. They offer a deal. I'm to work 10 to 3:30 every day, and I'm restricted to light admin work. I'm to see a psychotherapist in Camden for an unspecified number of sessions, once a week, starting the next day. Psychotherapy, I think. Are you mad? 6 sessions? I need 2 sessions a day for 3 years. But I don't say this. I smile. I nod. I agree. I'm there the next day, 30 minutes early, in my best summer dress, with my good knockoff Mulberry handbag, hovering at the corner, smoking jetons like a French streetwalker. I look demented, but chic. All I need is a beret. My therapist is called Ruth Green. Did you hear how easily that rolled off my tongue? My therapist, Ruth. Session 1. I introduce myself. Sinead, pronounced S-H-I-N, Aid.
I'm familiar with the name.
She says she's familiar with the name.
Tell me, Sinead.
Pausing for effect.
Tell me, what brings you here?
I rant, I cry, and eventually tell my version of what happened, including all new embellishments. She seemed kind and caring. My therapist, Ruth. I hate her. The time races by, and at the end, Ruth says,
"Find your truth."
Oh, and that I probably need to think of therapy as a long-term process and not a quick fix. Thanks, Ruth. And for the lovely coaster I just bagged from your coffee table. I go to work early the next morning. I avoid taking the bus. The energy I use getting to work exhausts me for the rest of the day. I do no work. I spend most of the day on the internet or talking on the phone.
I turn around and realise it's the bus that I've just got off. I'm confused.
I have an interview with the police and my story is again retold.
It's the bus that I've just got off.
It's a cold and clinical version I give them. And when I finish, I weep. They also offer me counselling, which I accept. Adrian comes and sits with me at the desk and hopes I'm all right. I say I am, but can tell he doesn't believe me. Afterwards, I go home and sleep for the rest of the afternoon. A heavy, dreamless slumber. When I awake, I've a dull headache. I text Jimmy and ask him to come round. He turns up at 6:30 p.m. with some wine and flowers like it was a date.
What did the police ask you?
They wanted to know everything.
They wanted the full story?
Yes, everything. What I had for breakfast.
Did they think you were involved?
No, why? What kind of question is that? I snap back and immediately feel regret.
And no reason. I thought they might want to exclude you.
They wanted a description of the man with the backpack. I can only remember his kind eyes. I think they believe he was the one and I'm the last person he had contact with. This makes me special, apparently. Jimmy's left eye twitches and I can tell he's hooked.
Do you have to see them again?
Only if I remember anything else. I wanted to say that I see him every time I close my eyes. I wanted to say that somehow I feel guilty for what happened. I feel guilty that I didn't walk to work that morning.
Will you call them?
Yeah, they want me to have therapy. I mean, they suggested I should talk to someone. Imagine me doing that. We finish our wine in silence and make our way to the bedroom. Our bedroom.
Same as last night?
Jimmy asks as he quickly undresses me first and then himself. Yeah. I keep my eyes open and I feel detached in a good way. In the mirror, I watch his screwed up face and recently toned up body and wonder if he'd ever concentrated so much on sex when we were together. Afterwards, we lie next to each other without touching.
You must be used to all this,
Jimmy asks. Well, more than asks, really, when I think of it. He states it like it was the truth, like there's a spider treadling from me to the events. What do you mean? I ask deliberately.
The bombings. I mean, after all, you are Irish.
Guilt by association. This is the man I wanted to add to my list of husbands. Jesus, Jimmy, I'm from Cork. There's no terrorists in Cork.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry,
he says quickly, caught out in his smug English hypothesizing. I start to cry. I want to hurt him, but I feel I've hurt myself. He leaves like a thief at 9:15 p.m. The used condom, the wilting flowers and the empty wine bottle mock the time that he's been with me. I drift into sleep and find myself on the number 30 bus. As I board, I turn around to Mr. Pushy and tell him not to be so rude. All the passengers applaud and he turns around and walks off.
Businessman.
As the bus closes its doors, I scream that there's a terrorist on the bus. The young Indian man is embarrassed and gets off. Slowly, the bus moves up the Euston Road and I feel my head getting bigger and bigger. By the time I get to the office, it's the same size as my body, and I need to use my hands to keep it steady. The security guard in the foyer won't let me into the building, so I call the police on my mobile, and they arrive almost immediately with sirens wailing, and they arrest him for being a terrorist. The police captain tells me I'm to receive a medal for my quick thinking. My head continues to expand and eventually I'm lifted off the ground and I float over the city and wake just before I crash into the London Eye. Three nights later in bed, I tell Jimmy about this dream that I now have every time I sleep.
It's all about your ego, isn't it?
He says like a show-off and pauses waiting for a response. I can tell he'd been waiting for ages to say this. When did you become an expert therapist? I remember why we split up. I hate Jimmy's sincere look when he knows he's right and knows I'll never admit it.
The counsellor's going to have a field day with you. Just wait until you get asked about your childhood.
I conjure a painful smile. I feel like an engine that will never be fixed and will always require attention. We have now had 10 evenings together. Our routine is talking and sex, the two things that were long absent from our relationship. After the anything you want sex, Jimmy leaves. Tessa must be getting suspicious. I don't care. On the 2-week anniversary, I go for drinks with the office gang. I'm now special in the group. I allow myself to be chatted up by Adrian at the bar as I get around in. I look at him properly at the bar for the first time and realise how young he looks. Black hair, blue eyes, good body, and funny in a cheap Essex type of way. I leave the pub at 9 p.m. and allow Adrian to take me home. In the taxi, I check my mobile and Jimmy has left me 3 messages and 4 texts. He sounds desperate. Fleetingly, I wonder if he has admitted all to Tessa and that he wants to come back to me. This makes me feel sad, so I begin to cry on Adrian's shoulder in the back seat. Back at my flat, we chat awkwardly over tea and he kisses me hungrily. We have sex in the living room and it's good. He doesn't need any permission or instruction. I trace the black dragon tattoo on his forearm with my index finger. I want to say something to connect with him, but I don't. Instead, I remember a line from an old porn film that Jimmy liked to watch. So I say,
"You have considerable potential."
He laughs with a deep, chesty, comforting sound. Then I laugh as well for the first time in weeks. And then, of course, I cry and he holds me until I stop. He passes me some tissues and slowly walks to the bathroom. I gaze at his naked body and film of sweat on his back and wonder why I brought him home. I panic with the prospect of what lies in front of me, bringing men home to help me get through the evening. He walks back to the couch, comfortable in his nakedness and smiling. I turn towards the window and acknowledge the warm July breeze that drifts in. I realise that I can't bear to watch him leave. He sits next to me and wraps himself around me. I feel him grow as we lie in silence, and he covers my hand with his. Session 2. Tell Your Truth. Ruth is on fire. Open-ended questions.
And how are your relationships with other people?
Silence is reflections. And deep sighs. Smiles when I'm talking, hands clasped like a Magdalene sister. I almost laugh out loud twice in the first 5 minutes. I keep my story light. I say I want to explain. If I explain to her, it helps me understand. Understand, she says, like she's never heard the word before. No question mark. Then repeats it real slow.
Understand.
I can't help myself, so I ask, well, what don't you understand about understand? Question mark included. She smiles even more. Rigid smile. Kind of like she's imitating someone who's just had a stroke. I try a different tact. Interpret. Interpret. I repeat it quickly before she has the chance to reflect. I want to interpret my life in the light of this tragedy.
Good. We are making progress.
Jimmy is waiting outside the flat when I get there. The keys have been confiscated and locks changed 6 months ago when I gave up hope of him ever returning. He wants to know all about the session.
Did she ask after me?
Yes. She's worried about your infidelity issues and your repressed homosexuality.
Oh.
Honestly, first, give me the truth. Did you ever want to have sex with your friend Mark? This is an old scab. Under pressure one night, I forced Jimmy to rank his friends according to looks. Mark Pendleton came out on top, so to speak. So I use this admission when I need to goad. It clearly struck a nerve.
No!
But you think he's attractive?
Yes, but...
I'm not here to judge. I open the wine he has bought and sit. Jimmy pours himself a huge glass and fidgets. Go on then. Ask me anything. I know you want to.
Well...
He stands up, sits down. He clears his throat.
Let me see if I've got this right.
He stands again and starts to pace.
You catch the bus, the number 30.
Yes.
You see a young man with a rucksack.
Yes.
You sit, he smiles, you smile.
Yes.
You alight a few minutes later.
Yes. I get this strange feeling that he's leading the star witness to some high cliff and he's going to dangle me over it, and then once he's had his fun, he'll drop me.
You get off the bus, turn around, light a cigarette, and then there's an explosion.
And I drop to my knees.
You drop to your knees.
The scream ripped out of my throat.
Yes, yes, but the bus stop is just after the church.
Yes.
The explosion is outside the bank.
Yeah, so?
So don't you see? The bus didn't have enough time to get to the corner where the bank is.
But what are you saying, Jimmy?
Sinead, I'm proving that you weren't on the actual bus that got blown up. You were on another bus, the safe bus. Therefore, you were never under any threat.
I see what he's doing. He has constructed an alternative view of the morning. In this version, poor sad Sinead gets her facts wrong and she really is in the wrong place at the wrong time. Now, when we were together, I would have screamed at him at this point, cried, and then eventually needed to be comforted. But the bomb, my bomb, has changed all of this. I stand up. I touch his face. The star witness responds. Oh, Jimmy. This is not about the bomb that I witnessed. This is about you. You poor, sad, jealous, closeted, not quite one thing or another man. You can't bear that I've had this extraordinary, horrible, life-changing event. Now that I'm special, you are unspecial. You want to take everything away from me and bring me down to your level. But I'm afraid I reject your crafty but incorrect hypotheses. I was there on that bus and you can only dream about what that has done to me. So therefore, if you don't mind, Jimmy, pretty please with a cherry on the feckin' top, please go back to your imaginary girlfriend.
What? What do you mean?
She's left you, hasn't she?
No.
Yes, she has. You couldn't maintain sex with two women over any period of time. Who are you kidding? Two men, maybe.
No, that's not true. We're on a break.
Oh, just say no means nothing. I see the frustration in his eyes, and then he cries. He weeps and sobs. Finally, I've brought him to my level. I don't comfort him, as I think Find Your Truth Ruth would want me to allow him some space. As he leaves, he asks about the next night, and I say, I think we should have Chardonnay for a change. Session 3. Back to the past. Tell Your Truth Ruth seems a little off today. I wonder if she's had a bad curry last night, because although she appears the same, she's not. I can tell. It's my intuition. There's something not right about her today. She's got a lovely light blue linen top that I imagine must have cost at least £100, and a silver chain and pendant. As we sit, I drink her in. We go through the usual routine.
How are you? How was your week? How are you feeling? Sleeping well?
I tell her about Jimmy. She's not surprised. She heard it all before, I can tell. If she could talk freely, I wonder what it's like to be brought up like her. Find Your Truth, Ruth. Happy upbringing in Belsize Park? Good school, good university. Loving parents. Maybe one sibling. Head girl? Maybe not. If she was head girl, she'd be a real doctor. She drinks red wine in the evenings. She eats very few carbs. When she buys gifts for friends, it's either a voucher or flowers. If you are her friend, she'll make you chicken soup if you're ill. Everyone loves her, respects her, values her opinion. She is exactly the type of person that I want to be. If I could steal her life, I would.
You're a survivor, Sinead.
I let the word gently dance on my consciousness. I neither accept nor reject it, but take it with me when I leave. As well as find your truth roots gold cross pen. I hold it in my pocket on the journey home, as a prize. When I get home, I add it to my collection of treasures. Jimmy's mother's gold locket that he thinks he lost in Spain. My old friend Ellie's iPod. Paul from work's mobile phone. Oh, and a salt and pepper set from the Ivy restaurant. Mementos of displaced emotions. My tokens of triumph. Jimmy is back. Stayed away two nights. He returned with flowers and wine. He apologised. I accepted. I tell him that I'm a survivor. He acknowledges this in an innocuous, subservient way that's almost funny. Sexual relations are resumed with new vigour. He's still in and out in less than 90 minutes. In many ways, it's perfect. I talk, he listens, he talks, I tolerate his musings. We've sex, then he leaves. No promises, no plans, no emotional strings. I like the new Jimmy more than the old one. I still don't love him. Never have, never will. Isn't that bad of me? If he were to disappear tomorrow, it would be like misplacing a pair of slippers. I'd get over it. Just when you think life can't get any more complicated, enter my second husband, Eduardo. Yes, husband number two. I'm a real femme fatale. Eduardo, gay from the start. Best friend of my friend Jack. He needed the passport, I needed 11 grand. So we got married in style at Hackney Registry Office. My grandmother, the old bitch, she would have loved it. Another fiasco in her book. That would be the book of the dead, really. She passed 10 years ago. In attendance are half the gay men of South America, a quarter of the lesbians, a herd of drag queens, and little me. I have to say, even in retrospect, and considering all the hassle that little bastard has caused me over the years, it was the best night of my life. We danced, we drank, and we laughed. Only afterwards I realised Eduardo was trouble, needy, impatient, deceitful, and malevolent. Sometimes 11 grand is overrated.
Oh my God, why are you being so difficult? She's just right in there. Look, she's in the window. Do you see her?
He arrives at the flat with no announcement. Straight from Heathrow in a taxi and demands the fare. I refuse to pay and to let him in until he gets rid of the taxi driver. I tell him one night only and announce that Jimmy is coming round soon, so he has to make himself scarce. He knows something's wrong. So I tell him all about me and the terrorist attack. He is devastated and racked with guilt. He weeps. He decries all violent ideology. He's so full of shit. After about 10 minutes, we open his duty-free brandy.
I have broken up with Ernesto.
Again?
Yes. He's like the circle of life.
No. Eduardo is gorgeous. Tall, handsome, great smile, heartbreaker, and a body to die for. Ernesto, his husband, is on a scale of 1 to 10, a 15.
He said we should be more mature, that we should be less trivial.
All men are bastards.
Even the good ones. Can I stay with you until Ernesto arrives to bring me back?
For the first time, I say, no, Eduardo, not this time.
No, why not? You're my lifeline.
Not anymore. I'm more mature now. I'm seeing a therapist.
Is that wise?
You have to go tomorrow morning. If you're not gone by 8 a.m, I'm calling the police.
You are a drama queen. And I love you.
Jimmy arrives around 10 minutes later. We adjourn to the bedroom for wine and relations. Eduardo watches Sabrina the Teenage Witch on TV. 10 minutes later, we're done. And interrupt Eduardo and Sabrina.
Oh, hello, Jimmy.
Oh, well, hello.
You look very good. Have you been working out?
No, but I've been using more moisturizer.
It's Ucho. You're a handsome man.
I need to go now.
I hope to see you soon.
Bye.
Please, Sinead, never marry that fool, even if he pays you.
After Jimmy leaves, Eduardo and I drink the rest of the brandy and then have sex on the sofa in the lounge. Old habits. Bad habits. Nothing bad can happen to you if you're loved by this one gay man. In the morning, I go to work and Eduardo checks into the Savoy. He asks if I need money. I, like a fool, say no, and the fecker believes me.
Is he here?
Jimmy is like a jackrabbit in the headlights at my door that night. One foot in and one foot out. Story of his life. Why are you so worried? Is this about Eduardo? Don't you like him? I ask, leading him on. He likes you. Really? Yeah, he does. I think he fancies you. He does. He wants your phone number.
Don't dare give it to him.
Jimmy is like a man possessed in bed that night. Back at Find Your Truth Roots, I'm dangerously close to the last session and I've managed to stay afloat. So I'm sitting there and I think, someday this will be a memory. Then I realise that I've said this out loud. Ruth smiles.
Tell me about the anger.
What anger?
We all have anger.
She's so smart and so smug. Even you?
Yes, Sinead, even me.
I suppose you want me to tell you why I'm angry.
No, I want to know how you are angry.
She says this in her low, soothing voice. I don't understand.
Well, think about it.
I do?
Time's up for today, Sinead.
Furious. I'm seething. I'm almost shaking as I leave. I am angry. How are you angry? I walk all the way home, past the high street, past the back of the station, past McDonald's, past the bedding shop, past the park, the laundromat, and finally the corner shop. And I wave at Mrs. Patel, who's on the till, as usual. I sit in front of the window in the lounge in silence until it's time to go to bed. Thoughts have been raised, ideas have been pitched, and nothing makes sense. Or maybe that's how it's supposed to be. Next morning, it's tea and cornflakes, and think about the matter of how. How have I become what I am? Habit? Routine? Learned it from other people? Damn, that woman's good. I've learned it all my life. Back with Find Your Truth, Ruth, and I'm ready to talk. Before we get settled, I say, I learned it.
Good.
She says without missing a beat, like she's been waiting for me to catch up. Next to her chair, she has a magazine basket. From it, she produces a small ball made of sponge. She hands it to me.
This is Jimmy.
I take the ball and throw it at the wall.
This, Skittles McGee.
I take another ball and throw it at the wall.
Your mother, your father, the man on the bus, the bomber.
Millicent Murphy, my sister, my older brother Fintan, my younger brother Oisin, my boss, the manager in the Fox and Goose, the check-in staff at the Ryanair desk at Stansted.
We have a lot of work to do.
What can I say except to agree? As I stand to leave, the room is full of balls. Let me clean up.
No, no. It's all part of the service.
And so, for once, somebody cleans up after me. I like it. I float home. I buy a large bottle of sparkling mineral water from Mrs. Patel and make the hardest call of my life. Millicent Murphy answers after six rings.
What have you done now?
She laughs. I'm the court jester to amuse the Queen. Look here, there'll be no more of this. You used me. I had to be something lesser so you could be better.
Are you drinking?
No, sober. Sober for once, and I'm fed up. You've never really been a good friend to me.
Sinead.
She sighs, and the void between us is filled with a pull to something familiar, something old and nostalgic. To break with it makes me feel vulnerable. No, over and out. No more poor Sinead to be your not quite good enough friend. I know what comes next. Flattery, blackmail, and a passive-aggressive friendship. I realise that in one phone call, that after some reflection and a few sessions with a psychotherapist, I'm not that gullible.
I never did anything like that.
Yes, you did. You treated me like a fool. You treated me like someone who was never quite your equal. You laughed at me to my face. You stole my boyfriends.
Well, only the straight ones.
And every good thing that happened to me, but no more.
Wait, I can explain.
So she starts to launch into some explanation that involves her feelings.
I always felt that you were holding back.
Fuck away off. And boom, I disconnect. It feels good. Then, like a charm, they all get a call. Jimmy, Skittles McGee, Eduardo.
I'm glad the therapist helped, but don't be a victim like me. Trapped with no value to your life.
I was wondering if we should have a reset. You know, basically, we're like Ross and Rachel and we've had a break.
I was wondering if you'd consider being our surrogate. I mean, I expect you'd be a great mother if you didn't actually have anything to do with the children.
Or maybe we can have an open relationship. Whatever you want.
Think about it and get back to us.
They all get the same request. Back off and leave me alone.
Ah, Sinead,
don't be like that.
Are we breaking up?
Nobody argues with me. My beloved family I decide to leave for another day as I want to savour those calls and really don't have the energy. Last night I slept for 12 hours straight through. I was very tired. My Aunt Margaret used to say if you can sleep it's a sign of a contented mind. The people with bombs still walk among us, smiling as they take our lives and our options away. Sit on our buses and drive into us on our streets. See us as targets. Expect us to silently sit by and let them strike at us. Is it me that they hate and want to destroy? It haunts my mind. It's a mad world, but we all know that. I'll never fully understand how lucky I was and am. I'm still angry, but I'm free. I have choices, and isn't that what we all want? On my last session, I steal a large bunch of roses from Marks and Spencer's for Ruth. Hey, she helped me, but she didn't cure me. At the very end, I give her back the pen I'd taken. This is yours, I say like I found it somewhere.
Thank you, but you can keep it if you like.
No, it's too expensive.
Not at all. I buy a job lot from Costco every 6 months. Practically every client takes one.
Like a souvenir?
Maybe. They think it has value, but it doesn't.
Something only has value if you give it value.
Correct. It's one of life's great lessons.
And that's it. I learned something about myself. We hug. I leave.
Oh.
We've been listening to Sinead by Eamon Breen. Hilary Rose was Sinead. Tag Murphy played Jimmy. Helen Norton was Ruth. Eduardo was played by John D. Ruddy, and Sharon Mannion was Millicent Murphy. Other parts were played by members of the company. Sound design and sound supervision was by Pather Carney, Kieran Cullen and Ruth Kennington. Sinead by Eamon Breen was directed by Goretti Slaven. And if you've been affected by any of the issues in the play, help can be found at rte.ie/helplines.
rte.ie/drama on one.